If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
Welcome back to Monday Night, the best night of the week. Means it's time for another episode of RFRX. I'm your host, Kara. I'll be facilitating the conversation this evening with our amazing guest speaker. And with me tonight, co-hosting is familiar face, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great, but that's because I'm not in the path of a hurricane like the person who is supposed to be co-hosting tonight is. Poor Helen. Hopefully everything goes well there.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Helen is there in the path of everything. We are hoping she is doing well. So yeah, we'll be checking on her and everybody else. Well, we're not going to be checking on everybody else in Florida, but
and we're sending her our thoughts, but that's it. Stops right there.
Yes, exactly. That is what we are doing. So definitely, if you've got people there that you are concerned about, check in with them, see how they're doing. And yeah, hopefully they're doing well. So, all right, Rob, what else is going on with you this evening, this week? What have you been up to?
Well, I finally pulled the trigger and I registered for the PsyCon conference that's happening in Vegas just a month from now, actually less than a month now, the 20th to the 23rd, which I have been interviewing all the speakers of, including Neil deGrasse Tyson and Penn Jillette. That was so much fun. I interviewed 12 of the primary speakers and to try to drum up interest in the conference. If people were on the fence, it might make them decide to. And I felt funny because after I interviewed everyone, I said, well, I'll see you in Las Vegas. And I really hadn't, you know, decided for sure I was going, but I got my booster shot the other day. So now I'm reasonably comfortable that I will not get very ill if I get coronavirus. So I'm going.
Excellent. That is so exciting. I love all of your interviews. So I cannot wait to catch up on those.
Fun as hell to do and like very unexpected because it's like I just in the right place at the right time and I get to talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson for an hour. So freaking cool.
Oh, that is so cool. Yeah. And you're going to have to catch us up on all of the goings on after the conference too. I cannot wait to hear
about
it.
But of course, because I'm doing this conference, I couldn't go to another one. So I missed the one you were at. Tell us about that, please.
Yes. So we just had our fall excursion for RFR this past weekend. I just got home from it. In fact, I'm still wearing my sweatshirt that I got there from Mandisa Thomas and the Black Nonbelievers. She was there doing karaoke on Saturday night.
Oh, wow.
It was a lot of fun. And
What did she sing?
What was it? She sang twice. She opened it up and closed it down with two excellent songs that I now am blanking on the name of, but they were both good. And that went on until late into the evening, until I think the internet decided we were finished streaming. And I think that was probably what needed to happen because we were not going to be going to bed otherwise. It was a great time.
Did you get to sing?
People were blessed with being saved from not having to hear me sing. I think clinically tone deaf. I don't think there's an actual diagnosis for it, but if there was, I have that.
I've done karaoke once in my entire life because I cannot carry a tune, but I had enough drinks in me and somebody pestered me to do Summer Nights with them. And it was another guy. So yeah, I did that.
Good for you. I tell you what, it was a very welcoming crowd. Like there was no expectation that, you know, everyone had to be a professional singer or anything. Although Daryl did come on and do one of his amazing renditions of another song, the name of which is now escaping me, but it was quite impressive. I think he's been on here one or two other times and sang for one of his presentations, didn't he? But yeah, it turns out he can sing. He's been holding out on us. So that was a lot of fun. And of course, we had a bunch of really cool speakers who came and shared some content with us as well. We had several speakers who have been on RFRX before, as well as several people from our organization. We had a few of our leaders from the Secular Therapy Project came in and talked. We had Thomas Westbrook from Holy Kool-Aid was there. Yeah, he talked about the fear of hell. We had Aaron Lewis came on and talked about discovering healthy body image and sexuality. I got her book also. Highly recommend it. We had Gwen Blodgett came and talked about nudism and recovering from purity culture. We had Candace Gorham talking about, she did a mindfulness meditation exercise as well as her presentation too about secular grief. Gail Jordan did her talk about creating traditions and celebrating holidays and things as secular people.
Did Glenda attend?
Yes, Glenda was there as well, our senior troll smasher. That was great. It was so fun to get to meet with all these people in person too, that, you know, normally we know each other on Zoom and on Slack and in the online communities, and actually getting to have in-person contact was pretty cool.
Very cool. Well, since Glenda actually, her hometown is where the PsyCon conference is, Las Vegas, I might get to meet her there.
Yes. Oh, you should. Yeah, she is a blast. We had great fun. So yeah, I cannot wait to get together with everyone again at the next possible opportunity. So look forward to that next year. We'll start planning next year's excursion probably pretty soon. So, and are you going to go next year, Rob?
I don't know. I'm kind of committed since I write for the magazine for this conference to do this, and they're too close together.
So okay. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, I would say you can be there in spirit, but I'm not sure that you will be anywhere in spirit.
Well, if I was going to be anywhere in spirit, that's where I would be.
Hey, I'll take that. Love it. All right. Well, you know, I guess we should probably get started on tonight's program. What do you think about that?
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. Without further ado, Rob, do you want to introduce our guest?
I will do that. So our guest is John C. Wathy. He's a retired computational biologist. I've never heard that before, so we'll have to find out what that is. Whose interests include evolutionary algorithms, the biology of nervous systems, and electoral reform. Okay. He got a PhD in neuroscience at the UC San Diego and has spent most of his career working on computer simulations of protein folding. His book, The Illusion of God's Presence, explores the evolution of the emotions and intuitions behind religious belief, emphasizing behavioral and psychological research. His latest book is The Phantom God, What Neuroscience Reveals About the Compulsion to Believe. It relates the motivating force behind religiousness to the neural circuitry of embodiment, mother-infant attachment, adult sexual pair bonding, addiction, selective attention, hallucinations, and many other neurological surprises. Welcome, John.
Right. Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction. Let me share my screen to get us started. All right. I think that should be working now. Before I dive into the presentation, I just want to say that I am really grateful for everyone who made this event happen. I know it takes a lot of work, so thank you for that. I also want to say a quick word of appreciation for Daryl Ray, your founder. I have lots of warm, fuzzy feelings about RFR, because it's a great mission that you do, obviously, but Daryl was one of my first readers, one of the first people who appreciated my book and interviewed me. I think I had my very first podcast interview with him many years ago. So I'm truly delighted to be able to give this talk to an RFR podcast session. So let us go ahead and get started. Illusions take up a lot of space. When they are gone, life flows in. I'm going to be covering a lot of scientific ground in this talk, but I hope you'll keep this quote in the back of your mind the whole time. This beautiful thought comes from Dorothy Allred Solomon. It's from her memoir about growing up in a Mormon cult. Now, what she's really, what she's talking about here is her sister's metamorphosis after leaving the cult. But I think anyone who has broken free of religion can identify with this sentiment. I certainly do. In my case, a big part of what flowed in was scientific thinking. I quit religion at about age 15, and I've never regretted it, but I have looked back. As a scientist, I couldn't help but wonder, why do we do this to ourselves? Why do all cultures have these strange beliefs? Why does religion have such a powerful grip on the human mind? Now, of course, many scientists have written about this, mostly anthropologists and psychologists, but I felt something important was being overlooked. That something is what I call the illusion of God's presence, and that's our subject for tonight. My talk will be in four parts. In part one, I'll try to show through example what I mean by the illusion of God's presence. In part two, I'll present some insights from the science of visual illusions that we'll need later in the talk. Now, you may wonder what any of this has to do with religion, but be patient. I think you'll see the relevance in part three when I try to explain the illusion of God's presence as something intrinsic to human nature. My hypothesis makes testable predictions, and we'll turn to behavioral biology and neuroscience for some insights and evidence here. Of course, any good hypothesis should have explanatory power. So in part four, I'll show how it explains four long-standing puzzles of religion, one of which was pointed out by Neil deGrasse Tyson. So that's the map of where we're going. Now let's move on to part one. I said that the illusion of God's presence is something science has mostly overlooked. So to give you some context, I should first say a little bit about what science has studied about religion.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
Hang on just a second. There's a little window here I want to close. I don't know if it's on your screen or not. Okay. Science has mostly explored those aspects that contribute to human social behavior. Of course, this is an extremely important dimension of religion, and from it, we get things like belief in judgmental gods, greater cooperation within the in-group, greater hostility toward competing out-groups, rituals of sacrifice as proof of belief in loyalty, and group rituals that get believers moving and feeling as one. Now, in my book, I lump all of these together into what I call the social root of religion. But the illusion of God's presence comes from somewhere else. In this painting, the artist depicts it in a visual way, because that's just what artists do. But it's really not a visual hallucination. It's more a compelling feeling that someone else is nearby, coupled with intense emotions. And I can best convey the illusion just by reading you some first-person accounts. They seem to fall into two big categories, one of which involves a feeling that comes on gradually and persists, possibly for a lifetime. Now, this may be just a vague sense that the universe is somehow mindful and benevolent, or an ongoing feeling of God's love and presence. Here's how blogger Andrew Sullivan put it. I have never doubted the existence of God, never. My acceptance of God's existence, of a force beyond everything and the source of everything, goes so far back in my consciousness and memory that I can neither recall finding this faith nor being taught it. It is the air I have always breathed. And then there's the sudden and transient kind. Often these come in times of personal crisis or helplessness. This anonymous example comes from a collection of thousands of such reports. Then, just as I was exhausted and despairing, I had the most wonderful sense of the presence of God. He was in a particular place in the room, about 5 feet from me. I didn't look up, but kept my head in my hands and my eyes shut. It was a feeling of an all-embracing love, which called forth every ounce of love I had in me. It was the tenderest love I have ever encountered, and my sins were blotted out completely. Now, notice the strong emotions here, and also the spatial specificity of the illusion, in a particular place, at a specific distance. There's also typically an overwhelming feeling of knowing or sense of certainty that comes with these experiences. And this is so compelling that many people take it as evidence of God's existence. One of those is Christian apologist William Lane Craig. I know Christianity is true on the basis of the witness of the Holy Spirit in my heart. This gives me a self-authenticating means of knowing Christianity is true wholly apart from the evidence. And Francis Collins, director of the NIH, makes the same point, but with a rhetorical question. Why do we have a God-shaped vacuum in our hearts and minds, unless it is meant to be filled? Now, I'm sure some of you have already noticed that this is really a plain old God of the gaps argument. We don't understand these feelings. Science can never explain this. Therefore, God did it. The problem with this is that it doesn't really explain anything. It's untestable. It suggests no experiments. It's an intellectual dead end. Now, I don't question the reality of the feelings. I've had them myself. But I just see them as a fascinating puzzle of human nature that cries out for a scientific explanation. We'll get to that in a few minutes, but first we need some insights from visual illusions. Illusions happen when a neural model differs from reality. In the Ames room illusion, the identical twins appear grossly different in size. Because the brain has an internal model of rectangular rooms with horizontal floors and parallel walls. Now, if you look into this room with both eyes, the illusion instantly vanishes because your depth perception reveals the true shape of the room, which is not rectangular. But as long as you look with only one eye, you see the illusion, even if you completely understand how it works. This is what psychologists call cognitive impenetrability. Our conscious understanding of the reality of the situation is not enough to penetrate the illusion. This illusion comes from a different neural model. Is this a meaningful image or just some random blobs? Most of you will probably see only randomness here, but that's an illusion. The image as a whole really does have meaning, surprising and vivid meaning. But you could stare at it for hours and never see it unless I do this. And for some of you, it will help if I make the image smaller, so I'll do that too. I'm going to leave this here for a few seconds or tens of seconds. This can be very difficult to perceive for some people. Others will see it almost instantly. And it's one of those things that's kind of all or nothing. It either looks like junk or it just pops into your consciousness as a vivid and meaningful image. A few of you by now have probably noticed that this is the image of a woman's face. But for those who have not yet seen the face in this, I will try to help you out with some hints. First of all, her face is in profile and she's looking to the right. And I'm going to move my cursor over here and give you a few more hints. This is her eyebrow right here. This is her eye. This is the outline of her nose, which is mostly in shadow. Her mouth is open in an exuberant smile. This is her upper lip. Here's her lower lip. here's the outline of her chin, and here is her neck right here. So I hope that may have enabled most of you to see this face. This thing is called a Mooney face, after psychologist Craig Mooney, who used images like these to study perception in the 1950s. It's a grossly impoverished image, stripped of all color, shades of gray, and most spatial detail. When I had it upside down, I was making reality differ from your neural model of a face, which evidently expects faces to be upright. And even now that most of you can see the face, you'll probably lose that percept, or at least it will become much weaker, if I turn it upside down again. And there are two important lessons here. One of those lessons is that this is yet another example of cognitive impenetrability. We have trouble seeing the face in this upside down image, even when we know it's there. But if we turn it right side up again, our neural model fleshes out the stripped down picture and we get a much more vivid percept of a face. And that is the second lesson. Perception comes not only from sensory input, but also from what the brain expects. When the sensory input is impoverished, the expectations of the brain's internal models become much more important. Now, of course, if the image is not impoverished, it's easy to see upside down faces, and many of you will probably recognize this as Margaret Thatcher. Now, if you study these images carefully, you may start to see some slight differences, but overall, they give the impression of being very similar. And that is the illusion. Here's what they really look like. The only difference here is that the eyes and the mouth have been turned upside down in this image on the left, but that's enough to make her a hideous ghoul. And because Margaret Thatcher's face was the first to be abused in this way, the illusion is named in her honor. What this tells us is that there's a special purpose circuit in the brain for the holistic processing of upright faces. And our perception of the normality of a face and its emotional impact are absolutely dependent on that circuit. We are utterly blind to the ghoulishness of Margaret Thatcher's altered face if it's upside down. What the illusion cannot tell us, though, is whether that special purpose circuit is innately specified or is the product of experience. After all, we almost never see upside down faces. Maybe the brain is lousy at perceiving them because it just hasn't seen enough of them. So is holistic face perception innate or learned? Well, luckily there's a way we can find out. Twin studies are the gold standard for teasing apart innate versus learned aspects of perception. Identical twins share 100% of their genes, but fraternal twins only 50% on average. So if identical twins are significantly more alike in their face perception abilities than our fraternal twins, then that's compelling evidence of a genetic contribution. Now, to be able to do this in this kind of twin study with face perception, we need some measure of face perception that will give us numbers, and luckily there are some. I don't have time to explain these, but all you need to know is that these are sensitive tests of holistic face perception that give numerical scores. The twin study found a strong genetic contribution to holistic face perception. About a third of the variance across individuals comes from genetic factors. We even know where this circuit is in the brain because damage to the fusiform gyrus, shown here in red, causes profound face blindness or prosopagnosia. And it's not the whole area in red here that matters for face processing. If these two little red spots called the fusiform face area are damaged, then you get face blindness. Now, it's a little misleading to call it face blindness because people who have it can still tell you they see a face if you show them a picture of a face. But what they cannot do is tell you whose face it is, even if it's a famous person or a close family member. Also, the deficit is permanent. No other part of the brain can learn to take over the role of the damaged fusiform face area. The astonishing thing, though, is that face blindness is permanent, even if the damage happens in a one-day-old infant. This paper I'm citing here describes a teenage boy who suffered a stroke that destroyed his fusiform face area when he was 1 day old. He had profound and permanent face blindness, though his recognition of non-face objects was much less impaired. Now, what's astonishing about this case is that infancy is the time when the brain is most plastic, when the function lost to local damage can often be taken over by some other area of cortex, but not if the damage is in the fusiform face area. What this means is that the fusiform face area is an extremely brittle, single-purpose, innately specified circuit for which no other part of the brain can substitute, despite the fact that this thing is a learning machine. The whole purpose of the fusiform face area is to learn to recognize thousands of individual faces over the course of a person's lifetime. So it's not like there's no synaptic plasticity going on in this thing. It's extremely plastic. All it does is learning. That's what it's for. But it's a highly specialized kind of learning. And that's the important lesson here. Highly specialized learning of this kind requires a foundation of innate knowledge. And that insight suggests an interesting question. Can a newborn infant use any of this innate knowledge about faces? Well, it turns out that they can, and they do. Newborn infants have some holistic face perception. They spend more time looking at an upright Mooney face than one that's upside down. Also, they prefer a Mooney face to a similar non-face image. And we know from a clever habituation test that they see these two images as the same, but they see these two as different. So now we can turn to the illusion of God's presence and my explanation of it. What exactly is this? What aspect of reality is the brain trying to model here? What causes the illusion and how does it compare to the visual illusions we've been looking at? When I try to explain this in terms of biology and evolution, I sometimes get the objection that religion comes entirely from indoctrination, so my hypothesis must be wrong. Let's get that out of the way first. There are two lines of evidence that religion is partly a biological thing. One is the cultural, one is the observation from anthropology that religion is a cultural universal. And the other comes from twin studies, our gold standard, which find that religiousness is significantly heritable. Roughly half the variance in religiousness across individuals comes from genetic factors. But if religion is partly a product of evolution, then why would natural selection favor this? Well, my short answer is that it doesn't. It favors something else that makes us vulnerable to this illusion. I think there's a completely natural explanation for the illusion of God's presence, one that has to do with the peculiar constraints of human infancy. I think the neonatal brain is expecting something godlike, but that something isn't God. And we can see a hint of what it really is expecting in the Moreau reflex. This is an infantile startle reflex that's thought to be a vestige from our primate ancestors. As infants, they would cling to their mother's fur, and whenever they were jostled or startled, they had to reflexively reach out and grab on tight. I think you'll agree that it bears a striking resemblance to Pentecostal prayer. This is just one of many examples of what I call the infantile or neonatal root of religion, which I believe explains the illusion of God's presence. In contrast to the social root, the neonatal root of religion is characterized by belief in a God of unconditional love, maternal compassion and caring, infantilism in religious feeling and ritual, intense spiritual longing, and the illusion of God's presence. This kind of religiousness appears to be a byproduct of selective pressures for the survival of helpless infants. And I have formalized this idea as a hypothesis that has three parts. Part one is that a newborn infant has an innate neural model of its mother. Now, this is not a detailed image of a specific person, but just a sense of the existence of some vague and amorphous primordial savior out there somewhere. And here are the essential elements of the model as I conceive it. A newborn infant knows that its mother exists, that she knows how to help the infant, that she's able to help, wants to help, and will help when she hears crying. Now, there's a bit more to it than that. There's also some physiologically critical information about the mother providing nourishment through nipples that can be recognized by scent and touch and taste, about her having a melodic voice, a feminine pitch, about her having a face and some rough idea of what a face is and what it looks like. And on the left here, you can see what a mother's face does look like to a newborn with its still developing visual system. This image over here on the left is an impoverished image, sort of like a Mooney face. So you can see how it would be helpful for infants to have some innate capacity for holistic face processing. I'm suggesting they have more than that, especially in the cortex that will ultimately support social behavior in adulthood. But in infancy, it supports attachment to mom, the primordial savior. So that's part one of the hypothesis. Part two is that the circuitry that implements this innate model of the mother persists into adulthood, but normally lies dormant. And part three is that the existence of this circuitry in the adult can give rise to the illusory feeling of a loving presence, especially, though not necessarily, under conditions that mimic the helplessness of infancy. And these feelings are often interpreted in religious terms because a crude mother-shaped vacuum is easily misperceived as a God-shaped vacuum. This hypothesis is consistent with what we know about the newborns and hatchlings of many vertebrate species. Having some kind of innate knowledge is the rule, not the exception. A good example are the herring gull chicks studied by Nico Tinbergen. They have an innate visual model of the parent's head and bill, especially that prominent red spot near the tip. They peck at that spot to solicit feeding, and newly hatched chicks will do this without any prior experience. Tinbergen found that the chicks would also peck at artificial models of the bill. And if he exaggerated thinness, redness, and contrast near the tip, he could make a stimulus even more effective than the natural one. This is a classic example of what ethologists call a supernormal stimulus. In much the same way, I suggest that God is a supernormal stimulus for the innate neural model of mother. God is a kind of super parent who answers prayer, is perfectly loving, omnipotent, and omniscient. These exaggerated attributes excite that crude model of a mother even better than a real mother does. And when it's excited, the innate certainty of the mother's existence feeds the certainty of God's existence and the illusion of his or her sensed presence. Another useful metaphor here is the illusory phantom limb of the amputee. The phantom limb happens because the brain of an amputee expects the missing limb to be there. And that neural expectation creates the illusion. The patient's conscious knowledge that it's an illusion doesn't make it go away. I really like this metaphor because if you combine it with the previous one, you get a nice, catchy phrase. In the light of biology, the God of unconditional love is a supernormal phantom, not a supernatural spirit. God is a supernormal stimulus in the ethological sense to the innate model of mother, and God's presence is a phantom sensation in the neurological sense, because the innate model expects a primordial savior to be there, just as the brain of the amputee expects the missing limb to be there. And this similarity of the phantom limb and the sensed presence is more than just a metaphor. Both the phantom limb and the sensed presence are illusions of embodiment, one's own in the case of a phantom limb, or somebody else's in the case of a sensed presence. There's an interesting part of the brain called the temporoparietal junction that's involved in both of these illusions. I think this is likely to be one of several places in the brain where the innate model of the mother is implemented, but it's not the whole thing. If you stimulate this area with electric current, the subject may experience the illusion of a sensed presence, though seldom with any kind of religious interpretation. The spatial and personal aspects of it are there, but the divine love usually isn't. Those feelings of divine love may, however, come from this place. This is the orbitofrontal cortex, which I think is also likely to be an essential part of the innate model of mother. It's on the underside of the frontal lobes, just above the eyes. Now, of course, it's what the orbitofrontal cortex does that makes it interesting. In monkeys, we know it's important for reinforcement learning. Neurons in the orbitofrontal cortex learn to become excited by a previously neutral stimulus, like, for example, a green triangle on a computer screen, but only if it is paired with a tasty treat. The tasty treat is called a primary reinforcer because it is innately rewarding, and the triangle becomes a secondary reinforcer only with learning. And by the way, the encoding of primary reinforcers in this part of the brain appears to be yet another example where innate knowledge is an essential foundation for learning. Now, we also know from neural imaging experiments that the orbitofrontal cortex is specifically activated in human parents when they see infants, and in infants when they hear their mother's voice. Now, it's this last finding, of course, and others similar to it, that are most relevant to my hypothesis about the innate model of the mother. But all of these things taken together strongly suggest that the innate model of the mother, or at least the part of it that's in orbitofrontal cortex, can be thought of as the set of primary reinforcers needing for learning human social behavior. This could explain why the innate model persists into adulthood. It persists because it's an innate foundation for learning. Primary reinforcers like gentle touch, a smiling face, an affectionate tone of voice, all of these are innately rewarding and drive us to connect with others, not only in infancy, but throughout life. The most compelling evidence of this is that damage to the orbitofrontal cortex in humans causes acquired sociopathy. Now, in this syndrome, cognitive abilities are normal. Things like memory, language, math skills, logical reasoning, all of that stuff is fine. The problem is that these patients can't feel the emotional consequences of reward and punishment. They lack gut feelings. Also, they can't anticipate how their actions affect others, so they are devoid of empathy. Because of these deficits, they make terrible decisions, though not usually rising to the level of criminality. But for example, they may lose their jobs, they make stupid investments, they go bankrupt, they get divorced, they remarry, very inappropriate choices of partners. In short, their lives fall apart. Interestingly, though, this syndrome is most severe when the damage occurs in infancy. As children, these patients are disruptive and impulsive in school. They're always getting in trouble for pathological lying, aggression, and stealing. They have poor hygiene and bizarre diets. They practice careless sex starting in their early teen years, and they make dangerously negligent parents. What this tells us is that the orbitofrontal cortex is an extremely brittle, innately specified circuit for which no other part of the brain can substitute. Well, that should sound familiar. We have seen this movie before. This is what we saw in the fusiform face area. And like the fusiform face area, this innately specified thing is a learning machine. Well, this is all fascinating. It says a lot about my hypothetical innate model of mother. But does the orbitofrontal cortex have anything to do with feeling God's presence? It should, if my hypothesis is right. But as you can imagine, that's kind of a difficult experiment to do. Ideally, you'd like to scan the brains of people in that critical moment when they're having the sudden and intense kind of feeling of God's presence. But that's a little hard to summon on demand. And yet, if there's anyone who could do that or come close to doing it, it would probably be these people, the Carmelite nuns of Montreal. They spend much of their time seeking closeness to God. And this image I'm showing here comes from their website where it had the caption, "God lives, I stand in his presence." Well, luckily for us, Montreal also has neuroscientists, and two of them persuaded 15 Carmelite nuns to be subjects in a brain scanning experiment. Their neural activity in a mystical state was compared to that in a baseline condition, resting with their eyes closed. In the mystical condition, the subjects were asked to remember and relive with their eyes closed the most intense mystical experience ever felt in their lives as members of the Carmelite order. And to give you some clue about what kind of mystical experience we're talking about here, I'd like to read you a direct quote from the paper. During the qualitative interviews conducted at the end of the experiment, several subjects mentioned that during the mystical condition, they felt the presence of God, his unconditional and infinite love, as well as plenitude and peace. So that sounds pretty close to what we want. What was happening in the brain during all of this? Well, the paper listed 14 brain areas specifically active in the mystical state relative to baseline. I will show you only the top five. And at the very top of the list, the most active is the orbitofrontal cortex. So that's encouraging. Now, I don't have a specific interpretation for the next one in the list, the middle temporal area. But the next three after that, in the inferior and superior parietal lobules, those are all in or near the temporoparietal junction. That's the area that handles embodiment and where direct stimulation can sometimes elicit the illusion of a sensed presence. Now, I want to emphasize that all of this is merely suggestive. It does not prove my hypothesis, but it is at least consistent with it. Okay, so let's quickly go over the main points from this part of the talk. Religion is partly a biological thing. There's a neonatal root of religion that science has largely overlooked. God's presence is an illusion in high-order association cortex that retains an innate model of mother. In the light of ethology and neuroscience, God is a supernormal phantom, not a supernatural spirit. And finally, the hypothesis of the innate model of the mother leads to testable predictions, and we saw some evidence for that in the orbitofrontal cortex. A good hypothesis may also explain some long-standing puzzles, and tonight we have time to look at four. Puzzle number one, why is God two-faced? Why do believers tell you their God will damn you to hell, yet in the same breath insist that he loves you unconditionally? Well, you probably already know my answer. They are blind to this blatant contradiction because of powerful intuitions from the social and neonatal roots of religion, which tell them that both descriptions of God must be true. Now, if I'm right about this, if these really are the dominant sources of religious emotion, then this insight applies to more than just the two-faced God. It means that religion is in some sense two-dimensional. If we mix the social and neonatal ingredients in the right proportions, we should be able to cook up just about any kind of religiousness there is. Or more precisely, if we could measure how much a person's belief comes from the social and neonatal components, then we could plot anyone in this space. Now, in my book, I include a rough draft of a psychometric test that tries to do exactly that. The latest version of it has 44 items that assess the 10 qualities in these two lists. Each item is a statement that probes one of these aspects of religiousness, and the respondents indicate their level of agreement. I'm pretty sure you've seen lots of psychological tests of this kind, but I'll give you some examples here. For a statement like this one, teachers should lead prayer in public schools. The standard way of indicating level of agreement works just fine. But what about one like this? God will never abandon me. The statement assumes that God exists and probes absolute trust in that God. Now, for an atheist like me, that's a bit confusing. If I say that I disagree, I seem to be saying, okay, there is a God, but I don't trust him. It's almost like being asked, have you stopped beating your wife? So to cope with that ambiguity, I've added another option for those who feel the statement just doesn't apply to them. So now you've seen a couple of items that'll give you some clue about this test, but I want to show you a few more just to give you a better feel for what's really being measured. Let's start with the social dimension and probing sacrifice. Here are a few items. People who don't contribute money at religious services should stop coming. I would gladly give my life to defend my faith. And I would rather my child die than lose his or her faith in God. Now, the first one in the list seems pretty tame compared to the other two. And the last one is so extreme, you might not think any parent could possibly feel that way. But I assure you, some do. That's an almost verbatim quote from a Christian mother. But over on the neonatal side, things look very different. Let's take a look at items probing infantilism. I sometimes think of God more as a loving mother than a heavenly father. I feel safe in God's arms. We are all God's children. So those examples should give you a feeling for what the test is trying to do, but the main point I want to make about it is that you should think of the test as a prediction. These two dimensions of religiousness should really exist, not just on paper, but in the minds and brains of the people who take the test. Now, psychologists have a clever mathematical tool for getting at just this kind of problem. It's called factor analysis. So I predict that if my psychometric test were to be given to many subjects of diverse religious backgrounds, then the social and neonatal items should naturally segregate into these two distinct factors in a factor analysis. That would mean that they correspond to something real in the human mind. Now, that experiment has not been done, but it should be. Okay, puzzle number two. Why are women more religious than men? This is probably the single most robust finding in the psychology of religion. Across nearly all religions, and by most measures of religiousness, women are significantly more religious than men on average. Now, of course, I want to emphasize that we're talking averages here. Obviously, there are many free-thinking women and many religious men. But on average, this just shows up again and again in the psychological tests of religiousness. So why? Why is this? Well, several explanations have been offered for this, and a few have some supporting evidence, but there's no scientific consensus on this question. I think there are probably several factors behind this gender gap. But the idea of the innate model of the mother suggests a new one, one that I think may be especially important because it makes some interesting predictions. I call it the crosstalk hypothesis for the greater religiousness of women, and it comes from something I showed you earlier in the orbitofrontal cortex. You may recall that both adult caring for infants and infantile longing for mother come from the same neural circuitry. That suggests that these two behavioral systems are correlated. There's crosstalk between them. Individuals with greater empathetic caring as adults should, as infants, also have greater infantile longing for mom, and as adults, greater spiritual longing for God. But there's one more critical piece to this puzzle, and that is the observation that women are more caring and nurturing than men. This means that they should have greater spiritual longing than men, which makes them more susceptible to the illusion of God's presence, and therefore more religious than men in the neonatal dimension. And that last part is important because it makes more specific predictions about the gender gap. For example, veneration of God as an infant should have relatively greater appeal for women than for men. On average, women will score higher on the neonatal dimension relative to the social than men. And greater nurturance or empathetic caring as a personality trait should correlate with greater religiousness of the neonatal kind, independent of gender. And I think we can see a good example of this in Francis Collins. He became a Christian early in his career as a physician caring for cancer patients. It I think it was his great compassion, not the infamous frozen waterfall, that brought him to Jesus. And that brings us to puzzle number three. Why do elite scientists believe in God? Years ago, Neil deGrasse Tyson pointed to this puzzle and said there's something else going on that nobody seems to be talking about. Something mysterious and alluring about religion that can seduce even the most brilliant of scientific minds. We cited these data from a paper in Nature. As of the late 1990s, about 90% of the American public believed in a personal God who answers prayer. For American scientists, however, that number is only about 40%. But when you look at elite scientists, members of the National Academy of Sciences, 93% of them reject belief in a personal God. That was the message of the paper. But Neil's point was that the authors had missed the most exciting and puzzling thing in their data. Namely, why isn't this number zero? Religiosity drops off with increasing scientific training, but it reaches a non-zero asymptote. Why do 7% of the most brilliant scientific minds in the country believe in a personal God? That was Neil's challenge, and it's a question he personally did not have an answer for. He just threw out the question. But he also went on to argue that if we really want to understand religion, these are the people we should be studying, not the general public. Whatever it is that can make believers out of these folks must be the most concentrated essence of the thing we're trying to understand. Now, one suggestion I've heard is that these 7% must have had heavy religious indoctrination as children, and so were more likely to believe in God as adults. That idea was not tested in the study of NAS members, but it was addressed in a similar survey of the equally prestigious Royal Society of London. Regarding the 5% of fellows of the Royal Society who believe in God, the authors write, "We also found that surprisingly, childhood religious upbringing was not significantly related to current attitudes toward religiousness." Now, this may have surprised the authors, but it doesn't surprise me in the least. My answer, of course, is that this comes from the neonatal root of religion. And what's seducing these elite scientists is the cognitively impenetrable illusion of God's presence. And again, this makes some testable predictions. Relative to the 93% of their colleagues who do not believe in God, this puzzling 7% of NAS members should be significantly enriched in women, physicians, and others who score high on tests of empathy and nurturance. And relative to those in the general public who do believe in God, the 7% will be significantly enriched in people who identify as spiritual but not religious, which is really just another way of saying that their faith comes mostly from the neonatal root. And finally, puzzle number four, why baby Jesus? I normally save this for talks I give in December, but my local store has already started putting up Christmas decorations on the shelves, so why not? Christianity, of course, permeates our culture, so you might not think of baby Jesus as much of a puzzle. It's such a familiar thing. But remember, Jesus is supposed to be a human incarnation of Yahweh, the God of ancient Israel. This is the God who killed almost every living thing on earth because he wasn't happy with the way humans turned out. This is a fearsome, omnipotent, punishing God. So why do Christians venerate him as a tiny, helpless infant? That's the puzzle. And of course, by now, you know the essence of my answer. Baby Jesus comes from the neonatal root of religion. But that's not the whole answer. I have been using this image of the Madonna and child to represent the neonatal root throughout this talk. But in doing so, I've glossed over something strange about baby Jesus. To see what that is, let's compare this image to some viral Facebook memes that also come from the neonatal root. Praise the Lord, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, His faithful love endures forever. That Bible verse here in this meme accompanies an image of a parent's hand, and there's a tiny little hand of a baby clinging to the finger. Here, the believer is the helpless infant. It's the believer who's got the tiny little hand clutching God's great finger. Here's another example. I worship God in adoration, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Again, the believer is the baby being held by the great, big, strong arm of God in this meme. Now, this is the kind of thing that my hypothesis predicts, that the believer is the baby. Believers will see themselves as helpless infants in relation to God, the loving parent. And that's what we observe most of the time. Most of the infantile imagery in religion fits this pattern. So why does Christmas reverse these roles, making God the helpless infant and humans the nurturing parents? That's the real puzzle of baby Jesus, and I have two explanations for it. One of them comes from my discussion of puzzle number two, especially my crosstalk hypothesis for the greater religiousness of women. Feelings of parental caring and infantile longing come from the same neural circuitry. So as I said before, there probably is some kind of crosstalk between them because they're being generated by the same neurons. Now, of course, the brains of infants are kind of stuck in the infantile condition. That's all they have. They haven't developed anything adult-like yet. But the brains of older children and adults can easily flip between these two emotional states, the adult and the infantile. That flipping is the same role reversal that gives us baby Jesus. Role reversal is easy, appealing, and seems natural because these two emotional states are tightly coupled in the brain. But my other explanation for role reversal comes from puzzle number one, the two-faced God, or I should say the two-faced nature of God. Now, on the right here, we have God, the loving parent, which again comes from the neonatal root. But on the left, we have God, the exterminator, the God of the social root. Now, if we zoom in on this area in the white triangle on the left, we see that God is drowning lots of helpless babies. That's a little hard to reconcile with the image on the right. Earlier, I said that believers are blind to contradictions like this because both versions of God come from powerful and innate intuitions. But sometimes, for some people, the cognitive dissonance is unbearable. Taken together, these images convey a really disturbing message. That loving hand of God I'm holding in the image on the right could shove me underwater and drown me. So luckily, however, if the God on the right is the one you really want to believe in, there is a simple way to eliminate the conflict. Just reverse the roles. Baby Jesus defangs the God of the social root by making him a helpless infant. Here's how Pope Benedict described this some years ago. God chose a new way. He became a child. He made himself dependent and weak, in need of our love. Now this God has become a child. Now this God who has become a child says to us, you can no longer fear me. You can only love me. I think most religions have both social and neonatal aspects. And baby Jesus is clearly an example of the neonatal. But he's also a special trick, a role reversal that emphasizes the neonatal root while diminishing the social root. This, I think, is why most Christians love Christmas. Most, but not all. Those with authoritarian leanings prefer a fearsome God. They want to restore their God to omnipotence, even at Christmas time. And this shows up in some interesting ways. If you want to make God great again, one approach is to condemn Christmas because it's heathen. For example, Hellfire preacher L.R. Shelton condemned the celebration of Christmas, ostensibly because of its pagan or satanic origin. But I think the real reason is that he just didn't want his fearsome God to be defamed. Jehovah's Witnesses do much the same thing, forbidding their followers to celebrate Christmas. And they're not just banning baby Jesus, they're also demanding a costly sacrifice. Prove your loyalty by giving up Christmas, something you and your kids really love. More commonly, though, the social root creeps back into Christmas in a more subtle way, not by condemning baby Jesus, but by saving him from the heathen. Here I'm going to just read a meme that I took down from Facebook. Facebook is trying to get folks to remove this picture from their profiles because it is offensive. Let's band together and prove them otherwise. So this is an objection, a supposed prohibition of Facebook to show this meme about, you know, the nativity scene. Well, obviously, this is just an example of the so-called war on Christmas. The idea here is that Christians are facing a threat, an imagined threat, really, from another tribe, the godless heathen who want to destroy their favorite holiday. Now, this particular meme is also a rallying cry. Let's band together. This is more like Onward Christian Soldiers than Merry Christmas. This is purely social root stuff. Now, the war on Christmas fantasy is relatively new, but intrusions of the social root into Christmas go all the way back to the Gospels themselves. No Messiah without a sacrifice. And here I'm quoting from Matthew, chapter 12, verse 13, the angel of the Lord appeareth unto Joseph in a dream, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and flee into Egypt, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. This, of course, is the story of the slaughter of the innocents. It goes on to describe how Herod, not wanting to be dethroned by an infant king, ordered the slaughter of every male baby in Bethlehem. But Herod is not the real perpetrator here. Yahweh is. He knows that Herod will do this. The slaughter of the innocents is a forced human sacrifice to a bloodthirsty God, the price humanity must pay for the gift of a Messiah. Again, this is pure social roots stuff. Now, if my explanation of baby Jesus is right, then a lot of the story comes from human nature, and we should see similar myths in at least a few other religions. And sure enough, we do. The story is not unique to Christianity. For example, baby Krishna of Hinduism, it has much in common with baby Jesus. Krishna is a human incarnation of the fearsome god Vishnu, rendered harmless in this adorable figurine. Like Jesus, baby Krishna is born to human parents who dearly love him, and figurines of this are popular in both religions. And just as Jesus is threatened by King Herod and saved by his human father, so baby Krishna is threatened by the cruel King Kansa and saved by his human father, protected during the escape by a multi-headed cobra. There's even a slaughter of the innocents in the Krishna story. King Kansa isn't sure which child of Krishna's family is a threat to him, so he kills Krishna's siblings. Now, as far as I can tell, this tug of war between the social and the neonatal roots plays out in all religions. So here's my take-home message for the coming Christmas season. The real story of figures like Krishna or Jesus, whether worshipped as a baby or as a loving sensed presence, is not about the supernatural. It's about human nature. You can learn more about this at my website, tuathiresearch.com, and of course, even more in my book, The Illusion of God's Presence. In this book, I promise a sequel, which I promise to explore in great detail the neuroscience of human religiousness. Now, that book is coming out next month. It's called The Phantom God, and I will join you again on October 24th to talk about that. And with that shameless plug, I will be happy to take questions. Just give me a second here to stop sharing the screen. And I think that should put us back to normal. Does everything look okay there?
Very good.
Yes, it does. Yeah, and thank you for that presentation. That was incredible. I was engrossed in it the entire time. That was really fascinating. I love what you did with that. It's amazing to me. It's like you took something that was in plain sight, the maternal imagery with the baby Jesus and all that, and really thought to look at it and unpack it. Wow. Excellent. And we do have a lot of questions for you. Are you ready to take some?
I'm ready to go.
Okay. Well, let's see. To start with, we had a few questions at the beginning about what you were talking about with the prosopagnosia. So one person says that I had a visual presence of my dead grandmother, who was Catholic, during a near-death experience, and it was hyper-real, and the remembrance of the vision is still as crisp to me today as it was 9 years ago when it happened. Can you explain a little bit more about how that happens?
Well, near-death experiences are really fascinating things. Those do tend to be visual hallucinations, and they usually come on not just in a time of emotional crisis, but in a time of physical crisis, right? That we wouldn't call them near death unless something seriously bad was happening to a person's health or safety. You know, they're maybe injured, they may be in a hospital setting undergoing surgery, they may be just sort of teetering in and out of consciousness or in some dreamy state. So without knowing more details, it's a little hard for me to try to interpret that, except to say what I just did, that they often have some kind of dreamy component to them. Sometimes they're more remembered than experienced, or they're recalled in a way that makes it difficult to tell exactly when during the physical life-threatening crisis the imagery really happened. Was it during my heart attack? Or was it after the heart attack when I was in the ambulance or being treated? So because of all of those ambiguities, it's a little hard to pin these things down and make sense of them. I would only say that having an image that looks like the ghost of a deceased loved one is a very commonly reported thing. It's why we have so many ghost stories in literature. It's a popular thing because people report it, people experience it. You become attached to someone who's really close to you. You spend a lot of time with them. Their physical image, the feeling of their presence, the sound of their voice, all these subtle details are burned into your memory. And they don't disappear when the person dies. And any little thing that triggers them, triggers some association to them, can sometimes be fleshed out by the brain, which is giving you a perception based on what it's expecting. I guess the only other comment I would make about that is, you remember I said early in the talk, especially when we were looking at the Mooney face, perception comes not only from sensory input, but also from what the brain expects. And the brain can be put into a situation where sensory input is diminished or even shut out altogether. And a near-death experience can be one of those. Taking hallucinogenic drugs is another, or being in a sensory deprivation chamber is yet another. And in those situations, when you're diminishing or eliminating sensory input, then the expectations of the brain become much more important, and you start perceiving things that the brain is expecting, maybe even on an unconscious level. It might not be a conscious expectation, but these things come bubbling up from the expectations of the brain, and you perceive them as if they are real. They look real, and we call those hallucinations. So that's the best I can do to explain something like that.
Okay, so I have a question. This is one sort of personal. Can one have a condition of partial prosopagnosia? Because I think I might have that. I'm awful at face identifications. We did a trivia game where the host thought it would be really cool for everyone to submit baby pictures, which actually could be anywhere up to 12 years old. And you were supposed to pick who that was currently playing the game. I drew a zero. And I knew that was going to happen in the previous experience. Other people got at least half of them right. And yes. Even when it was pointed out to me, this is Julie, this is Bill, I could not see it.
Yeah. That's a very perceptive question. And the short answer is yes. Individuals have, in the population, you can see a natural variation in the ability to do holistic face processing and to do facial recognition or identification of faces. Even familiar faces are difficult for some people in some circumstances. There's a wide variation in face perception ability, and that's normal. So don't feel too bad about that.
It can be embarrassing. I actually had we go to a country dancing thing, and somebody who's kind of in the front of the room for months, I didn't really look at her very carefully because I wasn't paying attention, but still it was the wife of the caller. And once she came over and introduced herself, and I said, "Hey, you new to this club?" And everyone looked at me with shock because everyone else recognized her as the wife of the caller.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's that does happen. There is variation. Thank you.
Well, that is really interesting to know. You're normal, Rob.
At least on that front. I don't say anything else about the rest of me.
Hey, speaking of normal, I have a question about one of the terms that you mentioned. You used the term supernormal when you were describing the stimulus that people were recognizing as God or God's presence. Can you explain a little bit about what that term means and how is it different from supernatural? Or is it different?
It's a great question. Yes, it is different. The term comes from ethology, which is the branch of behavioral biology that is concerned with behavior in the natural setting, behavior in a natural context. And ethologists are especially interested in how a behavior contributes to reproductive success, how it evolved. And they often, not always, but often concentrate on innate behaviors, behaviors that appear right after hatching or right after birth. When they were groping around for a word, for the kind of thing that Nico Tinbergen observed, for example, the herring gull chick pecking at the parent's bill and being fooled by an artificial stimulus that was even better at eliciting the behavior than a real parent's bill. Without without knowing what's in the dictionary, the natural choice for that word would have been supernatural, better than natural. That's literally what the etymology of that word means. And it would have been a great word for this use in ethology. The problem is we had had that word taken over by religious people for centuries before that. And supernatural means something that completely stands outside the realm of nature, something completely outside of the normal realm of human experience, and specifically something having to do with God, demons, spirits, the spiritual realm, all that stuff. So that's the only reason they were kind of stuck using a word like supernormal. They had to coin a word sort of like supernatural, but to mean specifically a behavioral thing.
Well, that makes sense. Thank you for explaining that. I had never thought about that before. It sounds like maybe the term supernatural is not a good one to describe what we mean by that.
Yeah, especially for the ideas that people like me are trying to put forward, that all of the things that people attribute to God, all of the feelings and you know, supposed prayer, spiritual healing, faith healing, the feeling of God's presence, all that stuff, I think can be explained as natural phenomena having to do with the way our brains work. And so, yes, I think it's a shame the word was taken from us, but oh well.
What can you do?
What can you do?
I was listening to a science podcast, which was looking back at old documents about people believing in psychics, and they use that word supernormal, in fact. So I guess they were insinuating, well, it's a normal process of the brain because they were believing in it. And yeah, they use that word, but not supernatural.
I have heard it used in that way too. And that rankles me a little bit. I feel like they're sort of stealing it from the behavioral biologists, but paranormal is probably a better choice for what they are trying to talk about.
I think that may have evolved because that was like, we were looking at news articles from 100 years ago. So it may have evolved into that. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So another question is, do we have any idea how innate behavior is programmed into the DNA and then into the developing brain?
That is a great question. I don't really know, except that I guess the one thing I can say about that is that I've read a theoretical chapter. So it's actually part of a book, but it's one chapter in particular. It's a book about the orbital frontal cortex and how it does reinforcement learning. And this particular chapter was a theoretical idea. It was a computer model of how the synapses could work in the orbital frontal cortex to do reinforcement learning with innately specified primary reinforcers. So their question was, you've got this learning machine that has to make these associations to primary reinforcers. How could it possibly be done? And the only way they could do it was to have non-modifiable synapses. The brain, according to their theoretical work, should have non-modifiable synapses, and those should be necessary, not just a nice handy thing, but they should be necessary for doing innate modeling of something like, you know, the innate model of mother, the innate idea that the face should be upright, all of that kind of stuff should be handled by non-modifiable synapses. And I don't know to what extent that idea has been tested.
I mean, it would apply to all the instinctual behavior in animals. Like, you know, baby turtles come out of the shell. I know they got to go to the water.
Right, yeah. Right. Hmm. Okay.
That is interesting. Okay, I have another question here that is related to several people ask kind of similar or related question to this. As you're talking about this, there's a lot of discussion of this, you know, sort of maternal, you know, mothering, nurturing sense that's going on here. So with that in mind, how is it then that God, especially in the Christian belief system, gets to be thought of as a male when so much of this explanation revolves around motherhood? What's going on there? And several people had kind of follow-on questions about, you know, is this some attempt to oppress and control women, or what's going on there with that kind of gender reversal?
Oh, that's a great question. I discussed that in several places in the book because the answer is deep. There it goes to many places, which we do not have time to cover tonight, but I'll give you some of the essence of it. Well, first of all, there's a short answer, which is that mostly the male image of God comes from the social root of religion, from that cruel, judgmental, punishing aspect of God. That's where the also patriarchal, you could throw that adjective in there. That's where the male aspect of God comes from. There's another dimension to that, though. There's another piece of that, which I haven't yet talked about. And that is that religion, especially the social root side of religion, the patriarchal side of religion, the authoritarian side of religion, that tends to be a tad misogynistic, sometimes extremely misogynistic. And there's something associated with that, that it's not just that women are being suppressed so that men can run the religion or run the society. There's something biologically deeper to it, and that has to do with the uncertainty that a man has about the paternity of his children. A woman can be certain that her babies are genetically hers. A man has less confidence in that. And men, therefore, should, according to evolutionary theory, be prone to, let me phrase it a little differently. If there are some men in the population who have a tendency to want to control their women, to watch them very carefully, to isolate them, to keep them from other men, that kind of thing, to guard them in that way, to assure the paternity of their own offspring. If any members, any men in the population have that tendency, that will be selected for because they'll show up more often in the next generation. And so that tends to be a male thing in humans, this tendency to dominate women in this way. It explains, for example, female genital mutilation, which is really a way of putting a tamper evidence seal on a girl's vagina before she's old enough to start having sex. So that's kind of a creepy and disturbing answer to the question, but it's an important part of it. And like I said, I go into more detail on that. But there's another thing I'd like to mention on that subject, and that is that even in patriarchal sort of authoritarian religions, which Catholicism tends to be, for example, the maternal or feminine aspects of God tend to creep into the religion anyway, whether the Pope wants them to or not. A great example of that is the veneration of the Virgin Mary in Catholicism. Virgin Mary is a big deal in Catholicism, much more than for Protestants. They pray to her, they pray the rosary to her. She is their intercessor between them and the fearsome judgmental God, the judgmental Yahweh. Also, female saints, who are also sort of intermediate deities, they're sort of lower hierarchical deities in Catholicism. The faithful pray to them too for special favors and needs. Two-thirds of them are women. They outnumber men 2-1. So those are examples of the neonatal side, the feminine side of religion creeping back in, whether the authorities try to prevent it or not. You can even see examples of that, for example, in Sufi Islam, a sect of Islam where the neonatal root plays a big role, much bigger than in what we, you know, most commonly think of in Islam, the jihadists, the people we see on TV waving AK-47s and so on. Even in that religion, you get the neonatal side.
Interesting.
Okay, so we have a question regarding the mother item here. Has any research been done in people regarding if their religiosity increases or decreases after a mother's death?
That's an interesting question. I do not know the answer to that. As far as I know, no, but it's, you know, there are so many psychological studies out there. That's worth a literature search. That's an interesting question.
Give you an idea for a paper.
Yes. That's a fascinating idea. I don't know the answer.
All right. Well, speaking of research results, we had a question about one of the puzzles that you were mentioning about the 7% of scientists who do have a God belief, and you had some proposed categories that they should fit into according to your hypothesis. Has that research been done, and do we know whether they do fit into the categories you mentioned?
So far as I know, that has not been done. I would love to see that answer. Now, I say, as far as I know, maybe it's just come out, maybe I missed it somehow, but as far as I know, it hasn't been done. Love to know the answer.
All right, we're getting lots of good future research ideas here. Excellent.
Okay, so let's see. There's a one that says, do you think women go to church not because they believe, but because we no longer have the tribe to help with childcare and other issues like that, and churches often fulfill such needs, and now they don't have that anymore?
You know, like I said, when I was talking about that gender gap in religiousness, I think there are several explanations. There's not a single answer to that. And the one you just mentioned could easily be part of that explanation.
So actually, I had a question regarding that when you were presenting that point, because it talked about how religious one is. And I mean, I have talked to people who don't feel they are religious, and my mouth dropped open when they said that. So I think the definition of the word religious varies amongst people. Even, you know, someone might think they're it's a Jewish person who keeps kosher, like really involved with the temple and whatever. And yeah, oh, I'm not religious. Like, what? And we never got to the point, well, what do you consider religious being? But yeah, that seems to be a little bit of an ambiguous term. So I think it's kind of hard to pin down in research that just says, if you're religious, you know, without defining what that means.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the reasons I made my rough draft of the psychometric test for the two, what I call the two dimensions of religiousness, the neonatal and the social. Those two, by the way, might not be adequate. The factor analysis might, you know, not come out the way I predict. It may be more complicated than that. But I think those two should at least something like those two should be in there. And I agree with you. We need a better, a finer grain way to assay religiousness.
Thank you.
All right. So we had another question about over here. If the brain functions that you described are innate, why is it that some people who are not sociopaths never experience the presence of a God?
Well, I would say that, you know, that does vary from person to person. And in fact, in our poll that we did at the beginning of our session here, when I was looking at those numbers, it looked like roughly half of people said they had experienced a presence. And about a third, if I remember correctly, said that they had this kind of vague feeling that the universe might be mindful or benevolent or whatever, or some kind of feeling of oneness with nature or with the universe. So it's something that varies from person to person. Some people are more likely to experience it than others. It's just like the trait that we were talking about earlier, the face perception ability, that it varies from person to person. There is variance across the population. So you will find some people who just never feel anything remotely like that, and others who feel it fairly easily. Dan Barker of the Freedom From Religion Foundation has said that he can summon the feeling of God's presence almost at will. He has to sort of get himself in the right mood, close his eyes, go through the mental machinations. He can just turn it on. He can make himself feel that. And now he, doesn't take it anymore as evidence of God's existence, but the feelings are still there and they come fairly easily to him. Other people never feel it.
Okay, so there was a couple of questions on this point. I'll try to summarize. It was when you were presenting the baby deity thing, and basically, like, all right, the Jews don't have such a thing in their religion, which is of course where Christianity came from. So, like, what about other religions without baby deities? And then someone just asked a question, which is sort of in parallel: how do you account for polytheism? Not all polytheistic gods feel motherly or saviors, and I would also say maybe don't have babies either.
Well, the only polytheistic religion I've done some significant reading about is Hinduism. And in there, you can find just about any kind of God you're looking for. They have a large pantheon. And as I said, with the example of Krishna, they sometimes take human form. Sometimes they are incarnated as babies or venerated, especially as babies. Among the world's religions, you see a wide variety, but almost any religion you take, I think, even something like Theravada Buddhism, which claims officially not even to be a religion, they sort of claim to be a philosophical discipline more than a religion. And they don't say or preach that the Buddha is a deity to be prayed to. Even in a religion like that, human intuition comes to the fore, rises up, and it will guide people's behavior, and they will pray to the Buddha for deliverance from some crisis or need. It just happens, and they can't suppress it. So I guess that's the best answer I can come up with to that. Religions take all kinds of forms. They have all kinds of dogma and rules and beliefs. But human intuitions just keep sort of bubbling up no matter what.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, that was excellent. Thank you for answering all of those questions. We definitely had a lot of engagement from the chat on this talk. So I think people are pretty excited about what you're presenting, and I'm pretty excited to read the book and get the rest of the details about it and your next book too, which I am going to drop the links for those in the chat once again, and they'll be in the notes in the show description for people who are watching this later on YouTube. But thank you once again for sharing all of this with us and taking the time out to come and do this presentation for us. And we are so looking forward to having you back again for the follow-up talk. I cannot wait.
Well, thank you. I feel exactly the same way. I'm truly grateful for the opportunity, for the invitation. Eager to do it a month from now. It'll be a great time.
Excellent. Well, we are glad to have you back again anytime. And
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.